This is Line One, Your Health Connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. An interesting report that I think has some bearing with my guest and the research and what we'll be discussing today, but we'll see if you can make the connection by the time the program's over. Anyway, it's been noted that women who have diabetes prior to pregnancy are more than three times more likely to have children with birth defects, and in fact, they're almost nine times more likely to have children with multiple birth defects. This has been reported in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and the research was done using data from the Center for Disease Control's National Birth Defects Prevention Study. They included about 13,000 women or mothers whose infants had birth defects and 5,000 who did not. So the question that I don't know the answer to is, how is it that diabetes predisposes to birth defects? And one of the possibilities, I suspect, is that there is something going on epigenetically. And hopefully, if you're interested in this program, you'll know what epigenetics and how this might pertain to this issue is by the end of the program. My guest today is Jocelyn Krebs. Dr. Krebs is Associate Professor of Biology in the Department of Biological Sciences at UAA. She received a Bachelor of Arts in Biological Sciences at Bard College, then went and got a PhD in Biochemistry and Molecular Biology at the University of California at Berkeley, and has done postdoc research first at the University of Washington of Massachusetts Medical School, and then I think you moved straight up here to UAA.
That's right.
Welcome to Line One.
Thank you.
I learned of Dr. Krebs. I think it was actually maybe a promotion from this program that she was going to be giving a talk about some work that she was doing some research on. And it was on frogs, as I recall, and something about epigenetics, which seems kind of obscure. And so I've asked her to start off by asking her to, how are we going to draw our listeners into research on frogs? And you also tell me Brewer's yeast is another object of your study, and how that might be important to us understanding some medical issues.
Absolutely. Well, if you think about it, there are really two reasons to work on something like a frog. One is, if you're an ecologist or organismal biologist, you care about what the frog does, how it lives its life. If you're a biomedical researcher like me, what you care about is that frogs are remarkably like humans in many ways. And in fact, that's even true of yeast, my other organism. In the case of frogs, what we like about them is the way an animal develops from a single fertilized egg to a complex organism with a spine like us is very similar for all animals that have that basic body plan. And so we can study the way organ systems develop, the way you get from a single cell capable of being any kind of cell into all the differentiated cells that create our different organs and tissues. And those processes are actually conserved in evolution between frogs and humans.
And frogs are easier to study.
Much easier to work with in the lab. That's right. We can fertilize them in vitro and watch them develop in a petri dish, and they're conveniently transparent. Some people who like to study development choose mouse as a model, and mouse has a lot of powerful advantages,
right.
And it's a mammal, so it's closer to humans. But, of course, all mammals develop inside their mothers, and it's very hard to watch development happen. Mm-hmm. In a frog, that happens outside the mother in a transparent embryo, so we can watch organs take shape. And when we perturb systems, then, we can watch what goes wrong very easily.
Your comments on this make me want to remind listeners also that if you look at our website, I've put a link to a book called Your Inner Fish, A Journey into the 3.5 Billion Year History of the Human Body by Neil Shubin. And the reason is exactly what you said, is this is a very good layman's overview of how body plans have changed with time, how they're predicted. It's a dramatic example of evolution and how people can go back in the right geological strata and find the missing link that wasn't there in various ways. And so when you use the word body plan, that's the first thing I remember. That's all that book is about, is body plans. And start from single cells to multiple cells. So where does yeast fit in on this? These guys multiply pretty quickly, I guess.
That's right. They don't have the same kinds of organ systems we do. Needless to say, they're different. What's wonderful about organisms like yeast, the very simple organisms, is the things that are conserved between yeast and humans, the genes that are identical, and there are genes that are identical between yeast and humans, those represent absolutely fundamental genes that you need for a cell to survive and to reproduce. And so we can study very basic processes in yeast, which are even easier to work with than frogs and much easier to manipulate at a genetic level, and understand these fundamental processes. These processes include the very basics of how genes get turned on and off, things like that, how cells actually do divide. Mm-hmm. In yeast, what we're particularly interested in is understanding how damaged DNA is repaired. Mm-hmm. So DNA damage is something that our cells are subjected to day in and day out. We haven't gotten a lot of sunny days in Alaska this summer, but if you do get out in them, you get that UV damage that's damaging the DNA in your skin. Our own metabolism, the process of getting energy from our food, creates reactive chemicals in our bodies that damage our DNA. All of that damage, if it's not repaired, leads to accumulated mutations, which ultimately is the cause of cancer, an accumulation of the right kinds of mutations to make a cell go haywire. So we study the basics of how those processes work. How do you recognize that you've been damaged, and how do you fix it using yeast as a model?
One of the things that I've gained the most respect for, and it's not in, to me was not intuitively expected, is that this ability to translate simple cellular organisms, mechanisms of metabolism are directly related to humans. It's clearly, it's becoming so obvious that evolution works just like we thought it did. Mm-hmm. And it's, the proof has got to be in the ability to look at a frog and learn things that are directly applicable. And actually sometimes, as you, I think we're going to talk about, you can move a gene from a human to yeast or vice versa and see that gene start working.
That's right.
Says there's, I mean, it's just not intuitively, I don't think, natural to think that that should happen, and yet it does happen.
It does, although when you think about those very, very basic mechanisms, once a cell has figured out how to divide, if you mess that up, that cell's not going anywhere. Yeah. And so those very basic processes tend to become fixed, in a sense.
And evolutionarily, they have a distinct advantage, and they will stick around until the environment really forces it something else down the road. And that's the whole principle of evolution. So in that sense, when you think about it, it does make a lot of sense. Okay. We're going to be talking about some very basic scientific research that revolves around the genetics and how genes work and how DNA repairs. So I want to spend several minutes talking about this whole mechanism of DNA and how DNA reproduces itself. How do genes get turned off? How does the same genome sitting in my eye as is in the tip of my finger? Why does the tip of my finger not look like my eye? Something is telling these genes to turn on and off at certain times and so forth. So let's just start talking about anywhere you want to help me understand what's going on.
That's right. So we'll start with DNA, and of course, what is a gene, right? A gene is a sequence of DNA made up of the four bases, the four basic building blocks of DNA, and that sequence creates a code that for genes that whose job is to make proteins, that code is translated ultimately to make the proteins that form the basic building blocks of the cell, do the work, the enzymes, digest your food, all of this sort of thing, or the work that the proteins are doing. But that's really just the body of the gene. The middle of the gene, in a sense, is what makes that final product. The way a geneticist thinks of a gene is not only what its product is, but all of the sequences associated with it that control it. So there has to be you don't want to make every protein in your body at the same time. As you said, different proteins are specialized for different tissues. So how do you tell one gene from another and have them differentiate so you can select this gene needs to be turned on in this cell type and not in another? And the elements that control genes are called promoters. And these are sequences upstream of the coding region where other proteins bind, more of the proteins that do the work of the cell.
So these promoters are sequences of
bases. They're part of the DNA sequence.
Yep.
That's right.
That are before you get to the gene.
That's right.
Okay.
We call that upstream.
And promoters are chemicals that recognize and bind onto this area?
Proteins, promoter-binding proteins.
Okay.
And there are many of them.
Okay.
There's a dizzying array of factors that actually whose job it is to recognize these promoters. A key factor, sort of the last one that has to land, so to speak, are what are called the polymerases, which actually are what transcribe the information from the gene. So transcription is the act of extracting that information from the DNA, turning it into an intermediate called RNA, which is chemically very similar, but mobile. You just make a short piece corresponding to the gene you're interested in, and then that's what goes off and gets turned into protein, translated into protein.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the proteins that bind the promoter, some of them just have this job of the work of transcription, but many of them have the job of the decision-making, recognizing that this is a promoter that you want to use only in a brain cell, for example. And the way those decisions get set up is at the very earliest stages of development. So from the time that you are a single-cell fertilized egg, decisions have to be immediately made before the first cell division, before you become a two-cell embryo. What's the left? What's the right? What's up and what's down? That's the very first pattern.
Yeah, where am I going to go?
That's right.
Where is this cell going to migrate?
Am I going to be a head or a tail?
Mm-hmm.
So the very earliest decisions are those simple ones, left, right, up and down.
And I would assume, I hate to interrupt, but the bad decisions right there end up in miscarriages.
That's right. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So
okay.
early errors in development,
bad.
You never even know you're pregnant as a general rule.
Yeah.
They disappear early.
Okay.
And essentially, every cell division, so every division then, each pair of cells you got from the last division is dividing again.
Mm-hmm.
So you exponentially start getting many, many cells. And at every division, decisions are being made so that cells can tell what their lineage is going to be, what choice they have to make next. And it's an incredibly orchestrated process. And these proteins that bind promoters, at each cell division, what's often different is the cell on the left makes one set of promoter-binding proteins, and the cell on the right makes a different set. That means all the genes that their offspring cells actually express were based on which promoter-binding proteins they made.
Hmm.
And so if you set that up correctly at the beginning, it becomes sort of a self-fulfilling pattern as each cell division then forces decisions on the subsequent cells. And as systems get more and more complicated, they start talking to each other. So cells will send signals to each other saying, hey, I'm going to be a brain. Why don't you make some skin? And vice versa. And so they'll help actually sculpt tissues by controlling their neighbors as well as their own gene expression.
And obviously all of the initial information and temporal sequence that this happens is in the DNA.
That's right.
Has to be.
That's right. Yep. So those early decisions are very hardwired. With just a few exceptions, there are epigenetic effects as early as sperm and egg coming together. There are certain genes that are never expressed from a mother and certain genes that are never expressed from a father. That's the phenomenon of imprinting.
Mm-hmm.
So even at the very beginning, there are some differences that aren't based on the DNA sequence but based on where that DNA came from.
Still the question is, what drives these messages to be started at the time that they do? What causes a cell to suddenly start allowing promoters to say, let's start moving and make this group of cells nervous tissue? Where does that come from? How does that start?
That's right. It comes from those very first decisions of up, down, left, and right.
Right.
So believe it or not.
Yeah.
And some of that, depending on the species, that information can start a little differently. Most species, there are some genes that are transcribed by the mother and the product's placed in the egg. So they're sort of ready to go, ready to jumpstart as soon as they're fertilized. And that helps control some of those initial activities right after fertilization. Mm-hmm. But it really is a cascade. Mm-hmm. Just falls out from that decision of once you can recognize your top and bottom, every cell division is essentially asymmetric.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Jocelyn Krebs. Dr. Krebs is an associate professor of biology at UAA. We're talking about some basic research in genetics and a term we've used already is epigenetics, which we'll talk about in a minute, and how basic research on things like frogs and even brewer's yeast is helping us understand some healthcare issues that are very important. So if you've got questions or comments about what you hear today, there's a couple of ways to get a hold of us. You can call directly at 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And you can also email us at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at kska.org. Normally, we replay this broadcast between 7 and 8 tonight, but tonight we're going to be bumped out to listen to a running simulcast. If you want to hear this again, you can certainly go to kska.org and get to line 1, and at any time in the future, you can listen to an archived broadcast of this program. Dr. Krebs, when I was in training, this was 30 years ago, it was the genetics was you got one gene, one protein. And then pretty quickly, well, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, I don't know when it was, people figured out we only got about 16,000, I guess there's still arguments how many genes, and there's a hell of a lot more proteins than that running around, so something didn't make sense. And then it's just been one, to me, just amazing revolution after another of as we understand what's going on in genes. And I'm trying to think of other things that are just amazing to me about this. But one of the things that we've talked about is use the term epigenetics. And epigenetics has to do, as I understand it, with as these genetic mechanisms are going on, they're in a environment, maybe in a mother's uterus that it's developing, it's being bathed in blood, that blood is somewhat affected by what mothers are doing, they're eating, their stresses, the pollutants in the air. And we're finding, if I'm correct, that those things affect these genes being promoted, turned on, turned off, and so forth. Is that epigenetics?
That's right. Epigenetics is, in sort of its simplest form, anything that changes the expression of a gene that does not actually change the sequence of the gene. And a classic example is one that we've already mentioned, this phenomenon of imprinting. All of our chromosomes, we get one copy from mom, one copy from dad of each of our pairs of 23 chromosomes. In imprinting, what happens is you can get so those pairs of copies have the same genes on them, or at least related copies of the same of these genes. If you get a gene that is so-called imprinted from your father, that means whichever chromosome you got from your father, that gene will be silent. You won't be able to use it, even though you can use the copy from your mother. And that's completely independent of the sequence. You could have the identical copies of the gene from each parent, but you're only going to get to use one of them. If you're unlucky, maybe you got a good copy from your father and a mutant copy from your mother, you'll still only be able to use that mutant copy. Now, those sequences have not changed, but some epigenetic effect, something beyond genetics, has forced you to silence the copy from your father.
I want to get back to that, but I was also thinking at the same time about some of the fascinating things that we've learned about the genome that I think worth discussing because people may have questions about it. And one of them that comes up is only about 1.5% or so of our whole genome is actually coding. Actually a gene. And that kind of blew everybody away. And for years and years and years, it was all this stuff, extra stuff was junk, which if you stop and think about it, really doesn't make evolutionary sense that we're going to be carrying. So now all these promoters, all this non-coding stuff is being found to be pretty important.
That's right. A vast amount of what we used to call junk DNA is absolutely critical. So you're right. It includes the these promoter regions, which can be quite extensive, can be mm-hmm. quite large. In fact, can be larger than the gene, the body of the gene, the coding part of the gene itself. But you also mentioned something a minute ago, which is how we have so many more proteins than we have genes. A lot of the non-coding regions in the genome are what are called introns. These are regions that interrupt genes. So a huge amount of this superfluous-seeming DNA is DNA that's been peppered around in the middle of what should be just a gene coding for a protein. And in fact, when you make your RNA copy of that gene so that you can use it, you actually have to take all this stuff out and put the little pieces back together to make something that'll actually make a gene. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out when you do that step, which is called splicing, putting together all these individual bits of the gene back into one continuous piece, you have different ways that you can do it. And so this is called alternative splicing. Mm-hmm. And it turns out we do a heck of a lot of this. Mm-hmm. This was a big surprise of just the last decade mm-hmm. or two that the amount of alternative splicing is immense. So from a single gene, you can make many, many proteins, and in some extreme cases, thousands of proteins.
So to make sure I understand this completely, let's say we've got a gene and a section of it is A, a section of it is B, and a section is C, and it may all be sequential on there, maybe A, B, C, but you can take that same gene and break it up to A, C, B, or B, C, A, and
actually, it's rarely the order that changes.
Oh, okay.
Splicing usually occurs in order, but you might have A, C makes a product, A, B makes a product, B, C makes a product,
okay.
and A, B, C makes a product. Right. And they could all be different right. and do different
things. So you
things.
Don't mix them around, but you may drop out not use a certain sequence.
That's right.
Okay, all right.
And in extreme cases, you can have hundreds of these pieces that you get to choose from. Mm-hmm. So you can end up with quite complex outputs.
And as if it's not already complex enough, one gene may tell another gene to get turned on.
Absolutely.
And they may not even be close together. I assume they may not even be on the same chromosome.
That's right. They're frequently not.
Wow.
And in fact, that's that developmental cascade again. That's mm-hmm. how you control these developmental cascades, is one gene that you make in one cell type will determine what genes you make in the next cell type when it mm-hmm. divides.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's back up and go a little bit deeper. Mm-hmm. Science is often said to be reductionist, and boy, this is getting
reductionist. Sure is.
So now we're trying to understand this gene transcription process, and DNA, as I understand it, is wrapped around something called a histone, and there's something called a nucleosome. So take us into the minuscule structure and paint us a picture of what's going on, and then how that gets changed epigenetically to determine what proteins get transcribed or what genes get turned right. on, because that's the epigenetic
that's
effect,
right.
really.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. So let me start with sort of a fundamental problem with all this DNA we have. We have very large genomes, and in fact, you know, our 3 billion base pairs that make up our genome, if you took all of the chromosomes from one cell, one human cell, lined them up end to end, you'd have about 6 feet of DNA, linear feet. Now, since that's taller than me, most people, many people, you have to fit that into every single cell in your body, and we're talking 3 trillion cells in your body.
Yeah. I mean, the answer to that is no, you can't. You can't do that.
That's right, but we do. And conveniently, DNA may be very long, but it's very thin. And so what we do is we have to compact it. And essentially, DNA gets wrapped around proteins, and the easiest way to visualize it is like wrapping thread around a spool. So it's getting coiled around mm-hmm. proteins. Mm-hmm. These proteins are the histones that mm-hmm. you mentioned. Mm-hmm. A nucleosome is what you call the unit of DNA mm-hmm. when it's wrapped around histones. So it's that complete, compacted unit. Mm-hmm. And all of that wrapping, that's the sort of the first level of compaction. That actually doesn't get you all the way. You wrap your DNA thread around these histone spools, and then you have to fold those up in a neat way. Organization is key, of course, because every time a cell divides, you need to be able to not have tangled chromosomes, be able to partition chromosomes into both the offspring cells. So this organization has to give you both extremely high compaction, and we're talking 100,000-fold compaction, but it also has to be very well organized so that the chromosomes aren't just a tangled mess, because you have to use them. Now, when you think about that level of compaction, think about taking, you know, 10 miles of string and trying to make it fit in a little ball in your fist. What if you need to find one particular inch on that ball of string? Mm-hmm. That's what looking for a gene is all about. Genes are buried in this very inaccessible context. So histones really become the gatekeepers of gene expression. The histones are what determine whether you can get at a DNA sequence when you need to express a gene or repair the DNA, the other thing that we've mentioned that you need to do with your DNA. The histones themselves have a core region, that's sort of that spool that I mentioned, but they also have these things that we call affectionately tails, which are extensions of the proteins that sort of bristle out from under the DNA. Those tails, it turns out, are sites of extensive chemical modifications, very dynamic chemical modifications in the cell. And there are many different kinds of modifications they can receive. What modifications they receive determine whether you can get at that DNA or not and what you want to do with it. So we call this the histone code. So very specific patterns of different chemical decorations serve as signal flags to say, this is a gene that needs to be expressed, or this is a gene that needs to be silent. This is a gene for the liver, but we're in the brain. We need this shut down and shut down permanently. And all of these signals really happen through the histones. So this is classic epigenetics in that you're not changing the sequence of the DNA, but you're determining whether you can use it by changing its environment that it's wrapped into.
When you say you need to get at that gene, what you're really saying is that the cellular machinery can't get at DNA when it's wrapped tightly around that histone, and then chemicals come in and attach to the tail.
That's right.
And that changes the chemistry and releases the DNA in a sense. It makes it more accessible to everything you the cells need to begin transcription.
Exactly.
So, and those chemicals that initiate this ability to allow DNA to be read are dependent on the environment and can be transmitted from person to person, but are not genetically transmissible. So that's what's different about it, right? So once that change has been made, it's potentially transmitted to offspring or other cells.
It can be very stable. That's right. It can be very stable.
Right. So that has nothing to do with who your mom or dad was. It has to do with where your mom was or what she was doing at a certain time.
That's right. It's a little of both.
Possible.
Because the chemicals are put onto the histones and to the DNA itself as it happens by other proteins. And these other proteins, of course, are also encoded as genes in your genome. Most of them are very essential and active in many cells in your body. So if you're deficient in the ability to put these modifications on histones or on DNA, that can actually lead to problems. But you can also have these modifications added in a not programmed sense. In either case, the modifications tend to be certain modifications tend to be very stable through cell divisions and generations.
All right. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Jocelyn Krebs. We're talking about basic genetics, how genetics have changed since the Middle Ages when I went to medical school until currently. There's been a huge change. We're not going to get into how we know what we know. I mean, the technology to be able to understand histones and unwrapping is just beyond me. I guess we're not going to go there, but just thinking about that is baffling in its own right. We're going to move on here to some of her research, which I think depends on some understanding of what we've just discussed. If you've got questions at any time during the program, 550-8433 is our local number. If you're outside of Anchorage, we'll give you a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And you can email us at line1 at kska.org. Is there any other basic information we need before we start talking about what you're doing research-wise? You think that's enough?
I think that gives the heart of it. If anything else comes up as we talk about it,
okay,
we'll jump in.
So how'd you get interested in biomedical research and then bring us up to what you're doing now? And
well, I've always been interested in biomedical research. I had parents in science in biomedical research. So I was raised with people talking about epigenetics around the dinner table.
No.
So.
Okay.
The only fourth grader who used the term Drosophila, not fruit fly.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So that's old.
Your environment affected
me. My environment affected me strongly.
All right.
But I've been interested for a long time in just these basic questions about how do you make sense of this incredible tangle of DNA that makes up the chromosome? How is it organized? And how is that information utilized?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And what I've been working on most recently are essentially this question of how do you get through the gatekeepers? How do you get through this barrier that histones really create in order to turn genes on and off? And study a group of proteins which are called chromatin remodeling proteins. These are enzymes, huge machines that use a lot of energy to actually shove these nucleosomes out of the way in order to gain access to genes. Doing this work, I ran across one enzyme in particular that interacts with a protein called the Williams Syndrome Transcription Factor, or WSTF. This WSTF makes a complex with another protein called imitation switch, and where these names come from, geneticists entertain themselves by coming up with some creative names. But the two of these proteins together create something called the Witch complex.
Mm-hmm.
The Witch complex, its job is to help turn genes on at the right time in the right place. These these proteins are highly conserved. There are similar proteins in everything from yeast to humans. And we were interested in the question of, this is actually part of a large family of related complexes. And the larger and more complex the organism, the more of them you seem to have, the more of these related complexes you seem to have. So we wanted to ask the question, what are they doing in an animal like the frog, which is a good surrogate for humans in terms of development? Usually when you have a huge complex family like that, one thing it might mean is different ones are specialized for helping you make different tissues. We also got interested in this because of the link to Williams syndrome, which is a very interesting disorder. And so I thought maybe we could go into a little of that for background. Williams syndrome is a genetic disorder caused by a chromosome deletion that we can talk about a little bit later that results in a really interesting, complex cognitive profile that's really a mixture of strengths and weaknesses. And if there are any parents with kids with Williams syndrome listening, they know that there's this really interesting balance. The deficits that are most common in these kids is a reduced IQ, usually between about 50 to 70, so moderately to severely mentally retarded. And they tend to have, again, varying levels of heart disease, but can be quite severe and can require heart surgery very shortly after birth. They have something called supravalvular aortic stenosis, which is a narrowing of the aorta, which is the large vessel leading from the heart, and that can be very severe. They also have problems with controlling the levels of calcium in their blood and vitamin D metabolism. So all of these are problems that these kids suffer. One of the most interesting deficits that they have is a visual processing deficit. They actually have a lot of trouble putting together what they see, or at least communicating what they're seeing. And an example of this is if you ask a child to draw a house, right, a small child to draw a house, most kids, even kids with comparable IQs, for example, if you take an IQ-matched child with Down syndrome, will draw something that's recognizably a house. A child with Williams syndrome who, you know, knows their house and can recognize their house might draw a squiggle for a sidewalk and a squiggle that they say is the roof, and none of these things will have any spatial relationship to each other. So their vision is fine, but how they process images is very distorted. And what's going on there is not well understood. They have brains that are about 15% smaller than a typical brain, but that's not uniform. Certain regions are smaller, certain are normal. So those are the disadvantages. But what's really interesting about kids with Williams syndrome is they have a couple very striking strengths. They are hyperverbal. They're incredible storytellers. From very early on, when they do develop speech, which is sometimes delayed, but when they do develop speech, they love to tell stories, and they learn amazing words that most adults might not even know. You can do a fun little test. You can do this yourself and see how many animals you can name in 30 seconds. A typical normal adult will start with family pets and then branch out to things they've seen on the Nature Channel. A child with Down syndrome might name a couple family pets. A child with Williams syndrome will name things like ibex and giraffe and things that don't normally come immediately to mind. Mm-hmm. And they use this vocabulary very well. They're also hypersocial. They have virtually no fear of strangers and want to make friends with everyone and talk to mm-hmm. everyone. And they tend to be very musical. They have a higher percentage of individuals with perfect pitch than the general population and often are musical prodigies from very early on.
Okay.
So very interesting syndrome. So why are we interested in it? Well, it turns out what's actually wrong at the genetic level with patients with Williams syndrome is they have a fairly large deletion on chromosome 7 on one of their copies of the chromosome. And that's important. They get this deletion from, mom or dad. Something happens in the sperm or egg. But the other copy is normal. And that's probably because if both copies were deleted, that would probably be lethal. They would not survive. That deletion takes out about 20 to 24 genes. So there's a lot of genes missing in these patients. So the challenge for researchers has been to figure out which of these genes are actually contributing to the clinical outcomes that we see in Williams syndrome patients. Just because 20 genes are missing doesn't mean all 20 genes are contributing mm-hmm. to what we see. And so we've focused on one of these 20 genes, which is WSTF.
Okay. Let me take 1 second. I know this is going to move us away from things, but we have a caller who's been on the air for a couple minutes.
Oh, absolutely.
And we'll come back to this because I think this is the crux of the issue. So let's take Jack on line one. Jack, what can we do for you?
First of all, great program. And I'm a male with breast cancer and also I'm left-handed. I wonder whether is it genes for that, because I searched my generation, like 5 generations of my family, and even though breast cancer in the family, including women.
Right. So the question I hear you asking, Jack, is you're a male with breast cancer. That's
yeah.
unusual, I would think, in my mind anyway. And you're left-handed, so the question becomes... my understanding is only about 15% of the population is truly left-handed. There's a lot of I don't know if the right term is cross dominance or not. So you're asking, is there a gene for left-handedness, or is there a gene for is it related to the breast cancer? Is that part of the question as well?
Yes, it's related to breast cancer.
Okay.
I'm the only left-handed person in my family.
Okay.
I can't find anybody else.
Okay. All right, well, let's see what Dr. Krebs knows, because you've already exhausted everything I know about this.
Well, I can speak to the breast cancer first, which is it's certainly true that there have been genes identified that when they are defective do predispose people to breast cancer. And, of course, this has been studied most extensively in women where there are much larger sample sizes of familial breast cancer. But the same genes actually can have the same effects in men. The most studied genes are two genes called BRCA1 and BRCA2, which are the breast cancer susceptibility genes, which you may have heard of. And there is genetic testing for those. And so if you see a pattern of especially early onset breast cancer in a family, you can get tested to see if you have that predisposition.
Well, I'm only 41 years old. And I was just stunned when I got breast cancer a couple of years ago.
That's right. So that... if you have kids, that you might suggest to them that they want to know, because then you can know to start monitoring very early if you're in a high-risk family. And, of course, with that family history, everyone in your family should be, males and females, should be monitoring very closely doing breast exams from very early on. Now, I've never heard of a link between left-handedness and any kind of cancer.
Okay.
But there probably are some genetic predispositions that control handedness. There's certainly genetic control.
That was my question also. Yes, that was my question, whether there can be a gene for hand, whether you're going to be right-handed or left-handed, and why only certain a small percentage of the population are left-handed. So, you know, why is that?
Mm-hmm. That's right. And I don't think anybody's ever mapped a gene for left-handedness. They've mapped genes that control whether your heart is on the right or left side. But for actual right versus left-handedness, it hasn't been mapped. And I don't think people have tried since, you know, of course, other than smearing as you write, there aren't significant disadvantages to being left-handed in a medical sense. And so, yeah, so I don't know if anyone's even trying to find such a gene.
Well, at least that's a small part of the population, so I really did not know the reason why to spend any time with it.
But it's an interesting question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. It's a great show, and I listen to it. Yeah, no, most of the time I'm in bed. I listen to the show most of the time. It's a great, great show. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, and good luck.
Thank you, sir.
All righty. All right, so let me remind our listeners, if you have questions about what you're listening to today, you can reach us at 550-8433. You can email us at line1@kska.org. This evening between 7 and 8, we will not be rebroadcasting because we're going to be preempted by a running program tonight having to do with some of the elections. But you can go to kska.org/line1 and listen to this podcast at any time in the future. Okay, so we're back to understanding that a lot of the basic genetics and metabolic mechanisms that humans have are conserved. I'm learning to use that word in a professional way. And what that means is even yeast or frogs have exactly the same process going on so that we can study that. And you have been describing a medical situation called Williams syndrome, which has some facial characteristics. It has some developmental characteristics and some possible heart and metabolic problems that you've mentioned. And you've been studying that. We know that it has a lot to do with a deletion of some chromosomal material in several genes on chromosome 7. And so take us from there.
Take us from there. So like I said, there are all of these genes missing, and really, up until this point, only one of them has been clearly linked to one of the clinical outcomes of Williams syndrome, and that's a gene called elastin. Elastin is a essential protein in heart development and blood vessel development, and it gets its name from the fact that it's an elastic material, so it's what gives heart tissue and the major blood vessels their ability to swell when there's large blood flow going through them and then snap back into shape when the blood flow drops between heartbeats. And it turns out that these patients have only half as much elastin as they should. And our aortas are made up of more than 50% of their dry weight is this protein called elastin.
Yeah, because of the deletion takes that gene out.
That's right.
And again, each patient with Williams may not exactly have the same deletion.
Well, what's striking about Williams syndrome is the vast majority of them do.
Ah.
And that's a caused by just a fluke of chromosome 7 that there are some large repeated regions on either side of this Williams syndrome deletion region. And it turns out that when regions are repeated in chromosomes, it's easier for them to be lost. And so that's what's one of the things that's made Williams syndrome a little harder to study. Patients always seem to get this, in the vast majority of cases, this very stereotypical deletion.
Okay.
And because it's a complex syndrome, it's pretty likely that more than one gene in this large group is responsible for different aspects of the phenotype. For example, the elastin defect is unlikely to explain musical ability or hypersociability. But because most of these patients, and there are a few exceptions, have the same deletion, it's been hard to narrow down what genes are important.
But because it's always or almost always the same amount of material, and then we assume the same genes, it allows you to begin to figure out what these genes do a little easier or easily.
That's right. I mean, at least it's clearly narrowed down to this region.
Right.
There's nothing else that we're worried about focusing on for Williams syndrome patients. It's very clearly linked to this deletion. So the approach that many researchers like myself have taken has been to take essentially tackle one gene at a time and ask, what is the normal function of this gene? What happens to it in a model organism, since we obviously wouldn't want to do this in humans, if you take it away?
Mm-hmm.
And does that defect that we see in a model then resemble any of the characteristics we see in a Williams syndrome patient, mm-hmm. which would give us an idea that it might contribute? For example, we know that elastin, if you delete elastin in mice, if you delete all copies, it's lethal. If you delete one copy, you get heart defects very similar to those you see in Williams syndrome. So we've taken that approach with this protein WSTF, which is in this group of 20 or so genes, and have taken the approach of taking this gene away from frogs and asking, if we take it away at the time of fertilization, what happens to the developing embryo?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I should say we've taken the extreme approach of eliminating the gene entirely. So not just going to a half dose. We've taken the sort of the most aggressive experimental approach of what happens if this gene is completely absent, because that's usually the easiest way to understand its function. When we do that, we get frogs that have actually seriously reduced brain volumes, much more than in a Williams syndrome patient. But again, it's a complete knockdown of this gene, and severe defects in the normal development of the eye. And so what we're hoping is that these defects are what we're seeing are extreme versions of the brain development defects that you might have in a Williams syndrome patient. Mm-hmm. And so the next step is to try and both understand what parts of the brain are reduced. That's what we're doing now, looking in more detail about what parts of the brain have been impaired by this knockdown, and then asking what happens if we ramp back to just a 50% level. Do we get something more similar to what we see in Williams syndrome?
This may sound goofy, and I apologize for it, but another characteristic of Williams syndrome is facial characteristics. They are very repetitively identifiable to a good observer, facial characteristics. Now, don't laugh. Can you tell the frogs? I mean, have
it's a great question. I forgot to say that, and that's a really important feature of Williams syndrome. I mean, in fact, these kids are adorable. The features are often described as elfin. They have very large eyes, small ears, little upturned noses, very cute. I have to say, and you know, I wish the listeners could see a picture of these frogs, because by no stretch of the imagination could they ever be considered cute.
Uh-huh.
But in the embryos, we definitely see facial malformations.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that is caused by the reduced brain size actually changes
sure.
the shape of the face.
Sure.
But we raise these to a tadpole stage, essentially. We don't metamorphose them into adult frogs.
Okay.
We don't know if they actually could mm-hmm. make that final transition due to their defects. Most of them don't survive to that point. So we've never seen anything that we would say
mm-hmm.
that looks like a cute.
In my understanding from
frog.
Quickly going into some of the genetics of Williams syndrome is that in this region where there's this deletion, there's multiple genes, and some of these genes, it appears from my reading, have to do with some structural characteristics of cells and so forth. So there's some very important bits of information in here that could also, in one way or the other, affect brain development, brain cell development, facial development, and so forth.
That's right. That's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of controversy right now. There are a handful. You mentioned patients that have something other than this typical deletion, and there are a handful of patients that seem to have most or all of the clinical signs of Williams syndrome that actually do have smaller deletions. Mm-hmm. And so there are a handful of genes that have been ruled out as probably not essential to what we see as causes for Williams syndrome when they're absent. But most of the other genes that are in there, people have come up with great ideas how they might be important, but there isn't really experimental evidence yet to make a compelling case.
There's an email that we just got. It's very detailed and complex, and I want to try to answer her questions. But before I go to that, one of the characteristics of human genetics is even identical twins are different, and so every person with Williams syndrome is not identical. And that raises the question of epigenetics effects on this basic genetic abnormality. Right. Have you looked at, are people looking at that? What do we know about why one person with Williams syndrome, for example, may have an IQ of 100? All right. Or, you know,
right.
little
that's,
different changes.
That's a great question. So there's sort of two answers to that. Without identical twins with Williams syndrome, of course, you can always make the argument that there are other genetic differences contributing to the differences you see. For example, there are many, many genes critical for development of the brain. And so if you're missing one or two in Williams syndrome, some individuals could have very strong versions of the gene of different genes that help offset the defects of Williams, or vice versa, that make it more severe because they have other genetic differences in their background. But you're absolutely right that there could also be key epigenetic differences. Mm-hmm. One thing that can happen when you're missing key genes is you can attempt to upregulate, overexpress, or downregulate, underexpress genes that might enhance or reduce the effects of your mutation. And so different individuals might be able to change the expression of other genes, again, not because the sequences are different, but because of epigenetic changes, as a way to essentially try and compensate during development for the defects. And different individuals then just might, because of their environmental background, do that better than others, and that could change the clinical outcome.
Okay. We've got about 6 minutes. Here comes a great email. So just keep in mind 6 minutes. So here it is. What can people do to ensure their DNA doesn't suffer from, quote, inappropriate, end quote, methylation? So this person knows we're talking about epigenetics, because methylation is one of the things that happens on that histone. So I understand nutrition plays a role, she says, where deficiencies in B12, folate, betaine, choline can impact methylation. Is this part of the good nutrition needed to DNA repair damage from cancer therapy? Do DNA repairing benefits of carbohydrate restricted diets impact epigenetics, or does it work via another mechanism? Is the P53 inactivation caused by HPV, human papilloma, an epigenetic change? Are there other diseases that impact epigenetic manipulation on human genes? So a number of questions, particularly around diet and how that might impact risks and nutrition and cancer.
That's right.
Lots to talk
Fantastic
about.
Fantastic bunch of questions. Yep. And this listener should email me afterwards for more detailed discussion that I can give in the probably 5 minutes we now have left. Let's see, which of those shall we tackle? Yes, it's absolutely true that I'll start with one that's sort of near and dear to my heart. Nutrition and carbohydrate restriction definitely do affect the amount of free radicals that we generate. So I mentioned way back at the beginning of the show that our own metabolisms create agents that cause DNA damage. One of the most significant agents of DNA damage is what we get as a result of getting energy from our food. And those are what are called reactive oxygen species, ROSs, or otherwise known as oxygen radicals. These are highly reactive chemicals that are just a normal output of our own metabolism. And when people tell you to take antioxidants or eat foods rich in antioxidants, these are the reactive chemicals that those are scavenging for you. So it's absolutely true that antioxidants will help prevent DNA damage, and our cells make their own antioxidants to try and do that. And caloric restriction, not just carbohydrate restriction, but total caloric restriction, which is known to extend lifespan in most species, one very prevalent model for how that works is by reducing the total load of these reactive oxygen species and therefore the total load of DNA damage. Mm-hmm. So the answer, the short answer is antioxidants good. Foods rich in antioxidants are very good for trying to prevent that accumulated DNA damage. So methylation is a really interesting question. So DNA and histones get methylated. As a general rule, methylation results in gene silencing. So aberrant gene silencing can be a very bad thing. If you silence a gene that's normally involved in controlling the cell cycle, controlling cell division, having that gene silenced can be a step towards cancer in that cell. However, it works the other way too. If you accidentally demethylate a gene that should be silenced and that gene is involved in growth control, you can get the same effect. And so it's true that a lot of people seem to get the impression that hypermethylation, too much methylation, is bad because it can lead to silencing of these essential genes, but it works both ways. And so every cell, it's a balance. What's happening right now is many individual cancers have turned up in which methylation of the wrong genes or demethylation of a different set of genes are actually promoting the cancer, and people are actually using clinically inhibitors that prevent either methylation or demethylation, depending on the cancer, mm-hmm. to try and treat that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I wouldn't advise anyone to find a diet that prevents methylation because it's important.
We're really not there yet.
Yeah.
I mean, huge amount of science yet to be done. And my understanding, at least if I can relate this to some of the stuff I read about allergy and where epigenetics play is small changes in just the normal genetic variation in individuals also is another factor, so that epigenetic changes in two different people may cause completely different
outcomes. That's absolutely
so
right.
So things are very complex, and you have to not – we're not ready for prime time.
There's not an easy rule.
Nothing yet here, so be careful out there. Okay. All right. P53 activation caused by HPV, you know what that means? HPV, human papillomavirus, P53 inactivation.
So P53 has been affectionately named the guardian of the genome. It's a protein that's absolutely essential in controlling cell division. And many viruses in humans and other species do act by sort of hijacking cell division control so that the cell will divide and propagate the virus along with it. But with limited time, that's probably all I can get into with that.
Well, we've really got maybe a minute left. Sum this up. What's driving you right now? Where do you see this going? What do you hope to gain from it?
Well, I mean, epigenetics is such an exciting area. And like you said, we're really just beginning to pick apart the incredible complexity, the histone code, understanding how not just methylation, which has been in the news a lot, but all these other chemical modifications interact with each other to create functional outputs. It's a really fantastic puzzle, and I hope to solve a piece of it.
So there's a lot of time to work on it. It'll take a lot of time.
It's
not going to be easy.
Although amazing, I mean, there have already been a lot of clinical applications from things that modify these histone modifications.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't get into some of the work that you have done related to cancer.
That's right.
Which would maybe make another show. But, I mean, there are therapeutic things being done now looking at cancer, which, like a lot of new things, you got to be a little worried about what we're doing.
That's right.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks very much. It's been the fastest hour I've had in a long time.
Thanks a lot. I
appreciate
it.
Next week, we're going to return, and we're going to be discussing the safety of medical imaging techniques. Our guest today has been Dr. Jocelyn Krebs. Next week, it'll be Dr. Brad Cruz as we look into how safe the medical imaging techniques are and can we do anything to make them even more safe. So tune into your health and learn more next Monday, August 25th at 2 p.m., repeating the same evening at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@ksKA.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at ksKA.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.